listening to the City World Radio Network. High definition digital radio broadcasting from the city to the world. www.cityworldradio.com.
Hello and welcome to Intelligent Talk, a new program here at City World Radio. I'm Ralph McElvenny, your host. Our first program is going to be on the Kennedy assassination. I'm very proud to welcome my friend and our guest, Ferris Rookstuhl. During his distinguished career at the FBI, Ferris spent 9 years reading over 500,000 FBI documents concerning the assassination. He has briefed the Attorney General of the United States, the FBI Director, members of Congress, and various international intelligence organizations on the Kennedy assassination. He's worked on numerous shows, such as Frontlines, Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald? And he was the ABC technical advisor on the 50th anniversary of JFK's death. He helped Norman Mailer on his book, Oswald's Tale, and is basically the world's leading expert on the Kennedy assassination. He's also a good friend of mine, someone I've known for almost 20 years. So, Ferris, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Oh, you're most welcome, Ralph.
So, Ferris, I just wonder if I could give my, which insignificant knowledge of the Kennedy assassination compared to yours, just because it's a complicated story, and then I'll defer to you and ask you some questions. Basically, to me, the Kennedy assassination is complicated because basically you have Oswald, who worked for the government, and he worked in Japan on, I believe, some programs to take satellite photos of the Soviet Union. Then he defected to the Soviet Union. He married a woman whose uncle was in the KGB. Then he comes back to the United States. He tried to kill General Walker, which is pretty well documented. He eventually kills Kennedy, and then he's killed by a man named Jack Ruby, who has ties to the mob. So if you want to make it a conspiracy, you have Russian connection, you have mob connection, you have a lot of very complicated areas that, to me, the assassination can go into. But if we could just walk it through and just to understand basically what happened, he was the lone assassin, correct, on that day, November 22nd?
I believe so, and of course the Warren Commission, in their official findings, as well as the House Select Committee and all of the government investigations, concluded that all of the shots that were fired and struck President Kennedy were fired from the sixth floor southeast corner of the Texas School Book Depository using Oswald's rifle. So Oswald was the assassin. Years later in the House Select Committee in 77, they thought that perhaps based on some flawed acoustical analysis, that there might have been a shot from the grassy knoll. But all of that has been since analyzed and studied further, and they have come to most of the National Academy of Sciences and the FBI came to the conclusion that the House Select Committee's analysis of a possible shot from the grassy knoll was indeed flawed, based on this open mic acoustical evidence. But what you have is the overwhelming evidence leads to one person, and that's Lee Harvey Oswald. And of course, the Warren Commission's summary in the introduction of the 888-page summary version said that Oswald, that they could find no evidence of a conspiracy, either foreign or domestic. And what that, in essence, means is that Oswald was working alone. Now, could he have been inspired by the Russians? Could he have been inspired by the Cubans? No one has any definitive evidence to that. So you are left with a shadowy hole in trying to shore up those holes into figuring out what was the motive, and did he have any confederates at large? And, of course, the evidence based on the investigative files indicates that while Oswald was on intelligence radar, that is, when he was overseas in Russia, the Russians were looking at him, and, of course, when he went down to Mexico City in September of 63, he was also on the official radar of the CIA, as well as Cuban intelligence, as well as the Russians. So everyone was looking at this guy, trying to figure out who the hell Lee Harvey Oswald was, what he was up to, And of course, the problem that we face is intelligence agencies like today don't tend to share their investigative or surveillance information, their raw data, with other agencies. So the Cubans were looking solely at Oswald on their own. The Russians were looking at Oswald on their own. And, of course, the CIA was looking at Oswald. And they're still trying. They were all these independent organizations. We're all trying to come to an assessment, to try to figure out what was this guy up to. Was he a dangle? Was he possible a foreign agent sent to try to get another government involved on behalf of the CIA? Was he perhaps sent by the Russians, or was he possibly working for Cuban intelligence? Some people have even posited that perhaps the national, the naval Office of Naval Intelligence might have had Oswald on the radar going back to his Marine Corps days, and then his defection to Russia, because Oswald held a basic security clearance, and the thought was that when he went to Russia, when he defected to Russia, that he might have in fact given some of this information to the Russians, because he overtly told people that he planned on doing that. And so you have this question as to, well, did the information that Oswald provided to the Russians, was that from his radar? He's working as a low-tech radar electronics technician in Otsuki, Japan. Did that information that he passed on to the Russians, was that responsible for the downing of Francis Gary Powers in May of 1960 with his famous U-2 incident?
Right, right.
Powers was kind of left wondering whether Oswald and his radar capabilities was possibly the result of his downing was based on Oswald giving this information. But from what I've been able to determine in my readings and speaking with numerous people, is that clearly wasn't the case. Oswald, when he was in Russia, they thought that he, again, could have been a false flag or a dangle, and they were suspect of him. And so the KGB wasn't eager to embrace him into Russia. And then it wasn't until Oswald tried to commit suicide that they thought, well, maybe this guy, we need to look at this guy a little bit further, because they were not going to grant him. Oswald had pretty much used all of his money to get to Russia, and then had no plan. Like many of his dreams, he had no backup plan, no where to go, no financial sustenance that was going to sustain him in that country. And so after he had traveled to Russia, wanted to defect, gone to the State Department and the embassy and said, here's my passport, I hereby renounce my citizenship, it kind of fell flat, because Richard Snyder looked at Oswald, who was working there at the State Department, looked at him as though this was a youthful indiscretion, and pretty much said, no, you don't want to do this. Why don't you just, think about it, and tell you what, we'll keep your passport here. And he didn't really accept the terms of Oswald's defection. So then Oswald is like thinking, well, okay, I've done this now. I don't have a job. The Russians haven't accepted me. So I have to do something drastic to prove that I am worthy of staying in this country. So that's when he tries to
kill himself, right?
Commit suicide. Exactly. And once he did that, that's when the KGB suddenly started thinking, well, they sent a representative to the hospital to really determine whether or not this American, this former Marine, had actually attempted suicide, and they were able to determine that that actually occurred. So they said, well, we should park apartment that was the equivalent of almost a hotel because of the fact that it was a fancy apartment. And what they would do is, and they would monitor Oswald. They could pick him up with a job where he could work at a radio factory, and they could have inside the apartment all these electronic listening devices, and they could listen to Oswald talk, and they could introduce KGB agents to try to get him to do things, say things, to determine whether or not Oswald was indeed an American agent. And what they ended up determining after keeping him in the apartment in Minsk, working at the radio factory, and he was making more money than I think the radio factory manager. And he was lazy. He didn't really want to do a lot of the work. And people resented him. And he had kind of this attitude about him. And so all the KGB was left with is approximately 2 years of a man who was doing nothing but fighting with his wife constantly. And they suddenly found out...
His wife, Marina.
His wife, Marina. They suddenly found out that Oswald, when they introduced an agent, a KGB agent, to try to get him to repair a radio, they wanted to see if he had any technical expertise. And he couldn't even fix a radio and had no idea. So the KGB did an assessment, and they decided that this guy was nothing more than an idiot. So they folded their operation, and they gave him 72 hours to leave the country. The problem was, Oswald didn't have any funds. He hadn't been planning to leave the country. He didn't have any money to leave the country. So he had to go back with his tail between his legs, go back to Richard Schneider, get his passport back, get a loan from the State Department and his family to be able to then come back to the United States.
Well, first, thank you to stop it. Oliver Stone, in his movie JFK, tried to make it into a conspiracy thing that somehow the government was giving him money to send him back, but that was just a routine course of business that he got money from his mother and made it back. It wasn't any conspiracy, correct?
No, that's correct. And in fact, it was, you know, they did a very detailed audit of his finances and during all the investigations, and they found that he, you know, there was no evidence of him receiving any sort of money from anyone else because he was very frugal in everything that he did, and it got to the point where he really couldn't support himself. When he came back, he had to live with his mother, whom he hated, and he's with his wife. They have a baby, and he's got dreams of going to Cuba. You know, again, he switches from Russia to now he wants to go to Cuba.
If I could just ask you to. So right now, when he comes back to the United States, at one point he goes to New Orleans and hands out the Fair Play for Cuba committee. That was sometime after he came back. He does a Fair Play for Cuba. He fakes the card. I don't think he was an actual member of Fair Play for Cuba, but it shows communist inclinations. Is that correct?
Yeah. What he was trying to do is when he comes back, he has all these jobs. He worked at the Jagger's Child and Stovall company. He orders his pistol that he would later end up killing Officer Tippett with, and he also orders a rifle, the same rifle that he used to shoot Major General Edmund Walker on April the 10th, 1963. Well, it was shortly after all of that, with the fighting with his wife, trying to kill General Walker, that Marina and Lee separate. So Oswald goes to New Orleans, and he has these fantasies. Again, Cuba is on the brink.
Okay.
Marina is living with friends, and then eventually moves in with Ruth Payne in Irving, Texas. And, of course, the resident in Irving, Texas, 2515 West 5th Street, is where eventually, after Marina starts missing Lee, and Lee starts missing Marina, they've had a little cooling off period while he's down there in New Orleans, he ends up asking for Marina to come down to New Orleans. They're going to try to reconcile. So Ruth Payne loads up Marina and drives her down there so that Marina can, in fact, stay with Lee. And she visits with Lee. But again, he's got these fantasies of Fidel Castro. In fact, he wanted to name one of his children Fidel.
One of his two daughters?
Or like, no way in hell do I want to have a child named Fidel.
He wanted to name one of his two daughters? One of his two daughters Fidel?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And so the other thing that transpired is Oswald wanted to hijack an aircraft. And in September of, I believe it was 62, he was talking about wanting to hijack an aircraft. And, in fact, what he ended up doing was saying, okay, Marina, what we're going to do is we're going to board the airplane. I guess it would be September 63, excuse me. We will board the aircraft, and I will storm the cockpit with my gun. And then what will happen is you'll go back to the back of the plane and give all the instructions, and we're going to hijack this plane and go to Havana. Well, Marina told Lee, said, well, no, I think that's a crazy idea, number one. And number two, I don't speak English. How do you expect me to go back and give instructions to all these people on the plane? And she said, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And she said, no, we're not going to do this. Well, one of the things that happened in the course of this is Lee's fixation with Cuba became stronger. He loved Fidel Castro. He thought Fidel Castro was like the underdog, standing up, you know, in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And the Bay of Pigs and all that, he was mad about.
And the Bay of Pigs and all that.
Yeah.
So he really fantasized about Fidel Castro. There's only one problem with Oswald and his fixation and fantasy with Cuba, is the fact that Oswald doesn't even speak Spanish.
First, may I ask, is there's just... There's several things I wanted to cover that various conspiracy theorists bring up. First of all, how do we know that he tried to shoot General Walker? What is the evidence of that? I mean, I'm sure he did, but what is the evidence that we can explain to people that he tried to shoot General Walker? They found documents in his house that affected. Am I right about that?
Yes. Well, actually, it's several key pieces of evidence. Number one, the testimony of his wife, said that Lee talked about killing Walker, and he really, they had a big fight at their house after he came home, and she locked herself in the bathroom and refused to come out because she was so angry at him for trying to kill General Walker. Secondly, they found photographs where he had stalked General Walker and photographed General Walker's backyard, where he ended up firing using the same rifle that he killed President Kennedy with.
The Manchester Carcano, the Italian rifle.
That's correct. And then the third thing is a written, almost like suicide note, that if I'm killed or captured, this is what you're to do with my effects. And that was all written prior to the Walker shooting as well.
Got it. I'm sorry. Let me just move on to some other areas, too. When he goes to Mexico City, I believe he goes to the Cuban or the Russian embassy, and the CIA, somehow the videotape from going into those embassies was lost. Was just an innocent explanation for that, or the video was not on, or how do we explain that?
Well, what they did was they actually did... two things. They ran pretty much a typical government. The CIA had a lookout position across the street. They also had an electronic surveillance. At the time, it was highly classified electronic surveillance program on the Russian and Cuban consulates. And so what they had was they had Oswald calling on the phone to make an arrangement to stop by the Russian embassy and him calling the Cuban consulate. But the lookout position for the Russian embassy, that is, ran kind of on an 8-to-5 government hours basis. The audio recordings were on reel-to-reel, and then after they were transcribed, they would tape over them. Now, there's only one problem with this. The Warren Commission, after the assassination, was able to listen to these audio recordings that were made by the CIA. They were able to listen to these recordings in Mexico City in a basement, secure room where they played a transistor radio or music really loud, and these guys were listening on a headset with earphones on, and it was a very secure room. And the Warren Commission listened to these conversations. There's also reports where the FBI, in fact, had the tape in their possession, but later it was changed to they had a transcription of the tape. And the tape itself was lost. Some argued that it was intentionally destroyed. Some have argued that perhaps it was negligence. I'm not convinced one way or the other, but I do think it's very odd, going back to the CIA, that in fact the CIA had this recording. And some people for years, you know, said, no, the recording never existed. They must have missed... they must have misreported that it was a transcript and the tapes were re-recorded over after 30 days. But my friends with the Warren Commission, more than one, have said, no, I was in Mexico City. I listened to the tape. I know exactly that, in fact, that was Oswald.
What?
Yeah, this is what he was saying.
Why would the government have destroyed the tape, in theory, just to not get into a potential war with the Soviet Union or make things hot, even though there was no connection? They were just worried that someone might make the link. Is that a possible reason why they might have destroyed it?
I think the biggest problem, and this is the problem when you have intelligence agencies doing surveillance, is going back in 1963, they had a thing called the Third Agency Rule. Third agency rule is like this. If Ralph McElveny has intelligence and Ralph tells it to me, Ferris Rookstuhl, I cannot pass that intelligence on to another person without going to Ralph McElveny and saying, hey, Ralph, can I give this intelligence that you told me to another entity? So what happens is in 1963, you have the CIA conducting a very, very highly sensitive, highly classified program in which they are surveilling Oswald, getting electronic information on Oswald through Russian intelligence and Cuban intelligence, and they don't want to compromise the existence of this program. So what do they have? They have a situation where Oswald is purported to have discussed with Cuban assets, as well as the Russians, his desire to kill people, kill Kennedy, kill Nixon. In fact, when Oswald visited Mexico City and went to the Russian embassy and spoke with Colonel Oleg Necheparenko and Valery Kostikov, he carried with him a pistol, same pistol that he ordered through the mail that he would later kill Officer Tippett with. He was waving it around, and they had to take it away from him. And Oswald, they referred to Oswald, Necheparenko, referred to him as like a tornado.
Ferris, I'm sorry. I'm just going to take a quick break, and we'll get right back into this in just a minute. Just 1 second.
Hi, this is DJ John Lombardi. You're listening to the City World Radio Network, www.cityworldradio.com.
So, Ferris, thank you so much. And by the way, it's Ferris Rookstuhl, RookStuhl.com. So, Ferris, thank you so much for just explaining that. And just in the remaining time that we have, I just want to discuss something else. There was a note that was dropped off to the FBI. Can you just explain that to me? And some people say it was a conspiracy that was destroyed, and that was evidence of Oswald's premeditated intent to kill Kennedy, and the FBI didn't follow up because they were somehow in cahoots.
Yeah, well, actually, the note, what happened was approximately 10 days, and the reason why we know the timeline is because of Ruth Payne making a note a notation that Oswald was discussing going to the FBI. Because, see, when Marina was living apart from Lee, the FBI, James P. Hostey, Special Agent James P. Hostey, Jr., was, in fact, trying to follow up to visit with Marina to find out information about Lee. And it really infuriated Oswald, and Oswald was under the belief that Marina was being threatened by Agent Hostey to deport Marina back to the Soviet Union if she didn't cooperate. So what happened was, with Oswald coming to the conclusion that the FBI was somehow tailing him, following him, or had interest in him, it sent him into a bit of rage. And he instructed Marina and Ruth Payne that if the FBI came out there again, that she was to write down the agent's name and the license plate number on the car, and that he would take it up with the FBI. So, in fact, that's what Oswald did. He wrote a note, and he said, the gist of the note is, if you don't quit harassing, you know, me and my wife, I'm going to take this up with the proper authorities. Now, Hostey claims that the Oswald note was not signed. I've never believed that. I believe the note was signed. And what happened was, Oswald took the bus, went down to the FBI office, dropped the note off with a receptionist, a lady named Nan Finner, a clerk receptionist, who opened up the note and saw that it was for Agent Hostey, because it was written on the outside, Agent Hostey. And he called Hostey Hastie, Agent H-A-S-T-Y, instead of Hostey. And she read the note, but the clerk, who was kind of known for not being the most reliable person, she claimed that she showed the note to several other clerks at the FBI, and that the note said that he would blow up the Dallas FBI office and the Dallas Police Department, all this crazy talk. And in fact, none of the other clerks that worked for the FBI recalled that. So when Hostey came in, the note was given to Hostey, who threw it in his work box there in his office and didn't think much of it. Well, after, of course, the assassination occurred and they determined that they had a file on Lee Harvey Oswald, and that James B. Hostey was the case agent, even though it was in a pending and active status classification, Hostey suddenly recalls that he has this note. And so he, in fact, goes in and tells his supervisor, who in turn tells the assistant special agent in charge, and of course the special agent in charge, that Oswald has written this note. So after Sunday, the 24th of November, after Ruby shoots Oswald, the supervisory members of the Dallas FBI decided that this could be potentially very embarrassing if Mr. Hoover found out about this in Washington, D.C. So Hostie was called into J. Gordon Shankle, the special agent in charge's office, and told he was to get rid of the notes. And he says, what do you mean get rid of it? He says, Shanklin said, well, Jim, there's not going to be a trial now. Oswald is dead.
Got it.
So this is not evidence, so get rid of it.
And he gets rid of it, and then that becomes a conspiracy thing for a lot of people, and just like the other things we discussed. But it just wasn't. It was just people covering an embarrassing situation, essentially.
Yeah, and that's how it was with the CIA. And I think CIA, also, they covered up things because had Oswald been talking about killing JFK, and they had information to that that they didn't provide on to the Secret Service and the FBI and other agencies in the government, you know, how bad does that potentially look?
So, Ferris, let me just turn your attention to the rifle, if I could, to Manchester Carcano. We know that he gets it out of a post office box, correct?
Correct. He got it from P.O. Box 2915 from Klein's Sporting Goods in Chicago, Illinois. And he ordered it using a money order that he paid for and signed. He mails it off, the money order, using his P.O. Box 2915. And the P.O. Box was registered under his name, and other persons that are able to receive mail there is Alec James Heidel.
Okay.
So he orders this rifle and ships to the post office box, and this rifle, you know, he would sit and practice dry firing the rifle at his house. He would go out to a range, and some even thought that he might have gone to the Trinity River bottom and practice shooting with the rifle. And, of course, then that's the same rifle he uses in April to try to shoot General Walker.
And, Ferris, if I could just mention one other thing. There's actually a photo of him that was on the cover of Life magazine holding that rifle, correct?
That's correct. That photo was taken by Marina Oswald on March the 31st, 1963.
And
later became Commission Exhibit 133A and 133B.
And he actually writes on the back of it, Hunter of Fascist, ha, 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 correct, in his own handwriting.
Well, actually, no. It's on the back of one of the photos, the only photo that he gave to a man named George DeMorenshield.
Well, you knew him, correct, Ferris, right? You do.
I knew him.
Yes.
And was very good friends also with his wife. But what is written on the back of the photo is a Holtnik Jaffa Shistami, ha ha ha, which means hunter after the fascists.
Oh, I see.
That's written in Russian by Marina. But Lee autographed the back of the photo and wrote to my friend George from Lee Oswald 5IV63. So it's April the 5th. He wrote it in the European style of a calendar date. And that's 5 days before he shoots at General Walker.
Got it.
That photo is autographed and given to him.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We know for a fact that the photograph, it shows him with the rifle, shows him with the pistol, and those were trophy shots that he made that he thought that he was going to be able to mail these things off to show that he, in fact, had killed General Walker and was going to be proud of it. And in fact, Marina was so embarrassed by the photos, and his mother was so upset about the photos, that they burned the copies that they had of the photos. And there's only, one original print or one negative that still exists, and that's of a different pose. But that same photo that you mentioned was on Life magazine, shows him holding the rifle and the pistol.
Ferris, I'm sorry. If I could I just want to get to the actual assassination, if I could. I want to cover all these, so many points to get to. It's such a complicated story. But the actual day of the assassination, November 22nd, 1963, as I understand it, there are three shots. Is that correct?
Yes. The majority of the witnesses said three shots. The indication from the physical evidence, with three spent shell casings on the southeast corner of the sixth floor, indicate three shots. The witnesses below the sixth floor window Harold Norman, Bonnie Ray Williams, and Junior Jarman, they heard the shell casings, the three step shell casings, hitting the floor from above them, and they knew for a fact that the three shots were coming directly above them.
Now, Ferris, his palm print was tied to the rifle, correct?
That's correct. And also a fiber from a blanket that was over in Ruth Payne's garage that he had wrapped the rifle up with. The paper was consistent, the wrapping paper that was left near the window, was consistent with the same type of paper that they used to wrap textbooks up at the Texas School Book Depository.
Okay.
And it also had fingerprints on it as well. And then the other thing is, its fingerprints were also found on the book cartons that were stacked up in the window.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, so three shots went off in what, like 5 seconds, something like that? 5 or 6 seconds?
Well, we don't know the exact time. We reconstruct the time based on a couple of things. We look at the Zapruder film, the 26-second film.
Okay.
And the Zapruder film, there's some debate as to when Abraham Zapruder, the man who was filming the 8mm film.
Right.
It doesn't have an audio track on it. So what happens is they ended up during the House Select Committee trying to look what they call jiggle analysis. And what that was is it's the startle reflex of when Zapruder is hearing the shot, which keep in mind the bullet is traveling roughly 2,000 feet per second, which would be faster, would be striking the victims faster than you would hear it. So what you have is you have three separate startle reflexes that appear in the Zapruder film. Some people have claimed that, yeah, there might be a couple of startle reflexes, but actually the first shot occurs before Zapruder started his camera because he started and stopped it as they were coming around the corner. That was him letting off on the mechanism of pushing to release the film as it's going through the camera. But what you have is the first shot, according to the Warren Commission, missing JFK and the limo.
Okay.
Where that bullet went, we have no idea. They never recovered anything to indicate that. But then you have the second shot, the shot that actually strikes President Kennedy in the back at 5 3/8 inches around C6 in his back.
Okay.
Goes into the president's back, comes out of his throat. Now, he's had a spinal thalamic reaction called the Thorburn position, which was first documented during the Civil War. And that's where you see Kennedy's hands go up towards his throat. And, of course, Kennedy is wearing a back brace, so he's pretty rigid in the car. And that bullet comes out of the president's throat and goes into Governor Conley. Now, when that bullet goes into Governor Conley, the bullet is starting to tumble as it's coming out the president's throat. So it goes in sideways, approximately 3 centimeters in length, in an elliptical jagged wound, and goes across, transverses across his rib, comes out below the right nipple, goes in backwards into the radius and ulna, causes what's called a comminuted fracture of the radius and ulna, and then goes out from the palm into his left leg, very superficial. And some people say, oh, you know, that's a magic bullet. Well, it's not really. You can shoot this round through 4 feet of solid pine board, and the bullet will come out looking pristine. The second thing about the second shot, which is another shot to hit the victim, is the shot that strikes President Kennedy in the head.
That's the third shot,
that
right?
That round, that's the third shot, and that round goes into the president's head right near the occipital area of the skull and breaks apart the parietal occipital bone and in 1/18th of a second. The Zapruder film is going through the camera 18.3 frames per second. The car, I'd like to remind you, is going at 11.25 miles per hour. How we know that is, the FBI reconstructed doing the Zapruder's camera, they were able to run the film through and see exactly how fast the film is going through the camera, and they looked at the stripes on the street and were able to determine from point A to point B that the car reached this location in 11.25 miles per hour. Now, 11.25 miles per hour for people that drive through school zones, and which is in most states is 20 miles an hour, that's roughly half the speed of a school zone. So what you have is the Zapruder film, when you see it on television, and it looks as though the car is going pretty fast.
Right.
What's happening is that has not been time corrected to video and actually slowed down. That's like watching old 8mm films and you see, you know, your grandpa or somebody pushing someone on a swing. It looks like they're walking fast. They're swinging fast and they're going fast. It's the same thing. It hasn't been time corrected to roughly 30 to 33 frames per second. So it looks like the car is going down the street at a very fast pace, and people say, there's no way you could fire the rifle three times. Well, what you have to realize is you don't start the clock until after the first shot, because when the clock is started, all you have to get off is roughly two shots in between 8 to 11 seconds.
Okay.
8 to 11 seconds. And that is not very difficult.
Right.
And so I have jokingly said that had Oswald not been as good of a shot, he could have thrown the rifle out the window and hit President Kennedy in the head and killed him that way.
And I would just say,
the car is
going
so slow.
Thanks to you, Ferris, I have Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge papers in my apartment, so I know he was a pretty good shot, wasn't he?
That's correct.
And CBS,
what you have is, He qualified at a distance twice the distance.
He did? Okay. Now, CBS News in 1967 recreated this exactly, didn't they? And they show that someone could get off three shots in that time frame with that accuracy using that exact same rifle. Is that correct?
That's correct. And there's also been others that have duplicated it.
Okay.
But what I like to remind people, when people start talking about a magic bullet.
Right, yes.
A magic bullet. Let's think of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan is shot in March of 1981, when Hinckley fires six shots with a .22 caliber pistol, the one shot that actually struck President Reagan is when they have on the suicide doors on the car, the limo, that were the backward opening doors.
Right.
The one bullet that actually struck President Reagan ricochets off the now bulletproof limo, goes between a roughly 3-inch space between the door and the limo, just at the nick of time that his lead agent, the special agent in charge of the detail, Jerry Parr, is pushing Reagan into the limo. And as he's going into the limo, that bullet, as Reagan is taking a nosedive for the floorboard of the car, that bullet ricochets off the car, goes in between that 3-inch space, goes right between the what's called the intercostal muscles of the rib cage, and stops within 1 inch to a half an inch of his heart, and didn't explode. This was called a devastator-type bullet, which is supposed to explode on impact. And they actually, when they were operating on Reagan, they had to wear bulletproof vests.
Really? Okay.
In the surgical suite, because they didn't know whether the round was going to explode.
So you're saying that basically these fluke things happen. That could be considered a magic bullet right there, bouncing off the car, hitting Reagan in that certain area. But these fluke things just do occur. It's not anything beyond that.
Things happen like that in nature.
Right.
Things happen like that in life. But to have someone try to say that there's no way, just because, you know, it's not common, doesn't mean it could not have occurred.
First, let me just take you to the time now, if I could, after he shoots the three bullets. So now, Oswald, what does he do? He goes down to the first floor of the depository, he goes outside, he gets a bus, and he basically is confronted by Officer Tippit, correct?
Well, let me back up.
Okay.
He stopped in the lunchroom. by a Dallas police officer and his boss, Roy Truly. And they wave him off like, oh, he's one of our employees, no big deal, and they continue up the staircase.
Okay.
Oswald walked out, actually, the rear. Most people thought that Oswald came out the front.
Okay.
He was stopped by news media coming into the building looking for a paid telephone.
Okay.
And as he's stopped, then he thinks, oh, no, they're coming through the front of the building. He circles around and goes out the back door of the employee entrance.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And then what happens? Yep. And then what happens, he takes off, and the man who drove him to work that day, Gil Leslie Frazier, who's standing on the front steps of the box, sees Lee walking on the side of the building crossing the street. And that's when, of course, he got on the bus.
And by the way, when he's driven to work that morning, he has stuff which has his curtain rod, which is actually the rifle, probably, correct?
That's what I believe in most of the investigators.
Okay, so sorry to interrupt.
He's carrying his rifle in there.
So he sees that same man again. He goes out the back. Okay, what happened? Sorry.
He goes out the back and he gets on the bus. Well, he's identified on the bus by a former landlord, a lady named Mary Elizabeth Bledsoe, who had kicked him out of renting her apartment because he was such a difficult resident.
Okay.
She recognizes him, and then he gets off the bus, gets a bus transfer, walks over two blocks, and catches a cab. Well, when he takes the cab to his residence at 1026 North Beckley, he doesn't just get off at the front steps of his house, or his room that he was renting. What he does is he has him drive him five blocks down the street, and the cab fare is 95 cents, and Oswald gives William Whaley, the cab driver, a dollar, which was a nickel tip. And even in 1963, that was considered to be extremely cheap.
Okay.
So Whaley remembered Oswald, not because of him being extraordinary, but because he was so cheap and frugal, he only gave him a nickel.
Interesting, okay.
So Oswald walks back to his rooming house.
Okay.
And this would be called, a lot of people in law enforcement would call this a dry cleaning effect.
Okay.
That is, he's trying to see whether the cops are showing up at his house, whether they're coming, so he can make a quick dash for it and leave. But instead, he walks into the rooming house, gets the jacket out of his room, his pistol, and some bullets, and then takes off.
It was a 38 pistol, correct?
It's a 38 pistol.
Yeah.
And so as he takes off, he's walking down the street, and this all-points bulletin is going out on the police radio.
Okay.
About a white male, slender build, you know, 25 to 30. You know, it could be half a dozen. I mean, it could mean, you know, half of the city of Dallas.
First, I'm sorry. Just one question. Just to debunk a conspiracy, why did that APB go out? Why was he considered suspicious? Because people heard the shots. He was on that floor. He left the building. Are those the reasons?
It wasn't. He was wanted. It was just a white male who was seen in the window doing the shooting.
Oh, okay, got
it. Because 120 feet from the window, a witness, an eyewitness, had seen Oswald, and he's the one, Howard Leslie Brennan, he's the one who gave the description of
in the
building. Right.
Okay, okay. So now the APB goes out, and then this guy, Officer Tippett, sees Oswald walking down the street, correct?
Correct. Now, Tippett is going eastbound, Oswald walking westbound.
Okay.
Well, a couple of witnesses said when Oswald crossed the street and he saw Tippett coming in his direction,
okay,
that he turned around and started walking, like spun around and started walking the same direction as Tippett's patrolling, and that's what caused Tippett to want to stop him. So Tippett stops him, speaks to him through the vent window.
So Tippett is in the car when he stops him?
That's correct.
Okay, and by the way, you're responsible for a memorial for Officer Tippett during the place where this occurred, as I understand it, too.
That's correct. I wrote a Texas Historical Commission marker, which is a state marker honoring Officer Tippett's sacrifice at the location where Officer Tippett was murdered.
Okay, so I'm sorry. So Tippett confronts Oswald, and Oswald just shoots him pretty quickly, or how does that occur?
Well, Tippett is not acting like, you know, this guy is connected with anything that's going on downtown. He stops him just because he's acting suspicious. He doesn't mark out on the radio, the police radio in the car. And he just thinks, you know what, I need to get some ID on this guy and see what this kid's up to. And, of course, as he gets out of the car, Oswald shoots him across the hood of the car. And
how many shots, Ferris? How many shots did he shoot him?
Three shots.
Okay.
Three shots, and then shoots him a last time into the temple on Officer Tippett and kills him. And then Oswald empties his shell casing in front of the Davis sisters' residence. And this whole thing is witnessed by about 12 people.
Ferris, forgive me. I only have 5 minutes left, so I just want to speed up. Then, as he goes to the Texas State Theater, he's arrested there. He's brought to the jail. Now I just want to introduce Jack Ruby. So Oswald, as I understand it, he delays the transfer from the prison because he wants to, like, put on a sweater or something. Jack Ruby has sent a telegram. He has a carousel club, which is basically strippers. He sent a telegram,
right,
leaves his dog in the car to one of his strippers. So he happens to arrive, not by any conspiracy, but just happenstance, when Oswald, who has now shot Kennedy and Officer Tippett, tried to shoot General Walker, is coming out there. And Ruby just is a hothead, correct? I have a letter from Jack Ruby myself saying basically he shot Oswald because Oswald broke the little pieces that were left to my heart. Rabbi Silverman, his rabbi, said there was no conspiracy in what he did. But what is your understanding of why Ruby shot Oswald?
Ruby, if he's wanting to silence Oswald, he should have done it on Friday night when Ruby was there with Oswald at the police headquarters. I mean, if you're trying to quick silence somebody, you want to do it at your first window of opportunity, because there was no way that Ruby could know that Oswald couldn't have, you know, started squealing and ratting out other people if they were involved in helping him.
So he had an opportunity to kill him there, okay.
He had an opportunity on Friday night, but, you know, he just lucked out on Saturday, and when he saw the smirk on Oswald's face as he's coming out, it just really angered him, and he just shot him.
But Ferris,
and he was still trying to squeeze the gun to shoot him again.
But I'm right that he just happened to arrive at the right time because he was sending money to a stripper of his by Western Union, and he left his dog in the car,
right,
which he loved the dog, correct? He would have left the dog in the car if he had planned it. Is that right?
Yeah, Sheba, his dog, his dachshund. He loved the dog, and he just was going down to see what was going on. The transfer was delayed because Oswald wanted a sweater.
Right.
And they also had some further interview questions by the postal inspector. And a lot of things, I mean, they could have moved him approximately 10 minutes earlier, and Ruby would have missed him entirely.
So basically, this whole thing is just an odd set of circumstances that Ruby happened to arrive at the right time, the conspiracy, that Oswald is working at the depository before he even knows where President Kennedy's motorcade route is going to be, that Marina Oswald's uncle happened to be in the KGB, but there wasn't a connection, that the CIA loses a tape of him going to Mexico City, but he had tried to... I mean, it's an amazing, as Nixon would say, comedy of errors of what occurred, and this amazing story, which filled with all these different areas, but it's just, at heart, one person killing Kennedy, no conspiracy. You also, Ferris, were responsible for fighting three hobos, who I think that there was an allegation that they were involved with, like, mafia hitmen. Didn't you help debunk that as
Correct.
Well?
And what, I did as well.
What was the story on that? What were they? Just three hobos? There was nothing more than that in the area.
They were three bums during the Garrison investigation in the late '60s. Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans,
right?
He was saying that these people were CIA hitmen, and people were trying to say that, oh yes, they were CIA hitmen. Well, no, they were just nothing more than bums, and. We interviewed two of the three. The third one was dead. Now they're all deceased. But we actually interviewed them and determined that they were, in fact, indigents who were just riding the rails in the in boxcars, which was near the switching area, behind the grassy knoll areas, as people call it. And they just happened to be in the wrong place.
I'm sorry, I just have 2 minutes left. Frank Regano was Carlos Marcello's lawyer, one of the head of the mafia in Florida. And he writes in his book that Marcello had basically did the assassination, was behind it, etc. When the FBI wiretaps picked up these mob guys bragging that they had done it, Did you just think that was just nothing more than people talking big and wanting to take responsibility for something, just like the way wise guys sort of talk in a social club, and it was nothing more than that?
Yeah, and in fact, we had a wiretap on Carlos Marcello in the prison when he was in Federal Correctional Institute in Texarkana. And I wrote the interview questions for Carlos Marcello before he got out of prison, and he was bragging. He was, you know, it's just typical, you know, trying to be the big guy, you know, to impress, you know, people around the prison. But there was no evidence whatsoever that Carlos Marcello was involved in planning, funding, organizing, or participating in any way the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
And no mafia involvement at any level, Chicago, Marcello, none, correct?
That's correct. And there's never been any conclusive evidence. People like to think, oh, yeah, the mob wanted him killed. A lot of people wanted JFK killed and talked about it.
They say because Bobby Kennedy turned on them and they helped him win Chicago with the votes and blah, blah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, first, could you mention your website one more time? Because we're running out of time and I want to give you an opportunity to mention your website again, please.
Sure. You can visit www.farris, F-A-R-R-I-S, Rookstool, R-O-O-K-S-T-O-O-L.com. And read more about my exciting times working for the FBI and the documentary films and books that I participated in producing and writing.
Farris, thank you so much. I'm sorry I had to rush you. We had to cover so much material in such a small amount of time, and you've been my friend for many years, and I've enjoyed speaking with you about this over the years and look forward to more talks on and off the air. And thank you so much for being my guest today.
You're most welcome, Ralph. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.